Doug, to broaden the cropping capacity of the area at that time. And then we find that he received a vision. Something came towards him from the sky, and that is described in considerable detail. Now, we have also looked on several previous occasions at the historicity of this section of Scripture. Because when we get to the time of the closing chapters of Jeremiah, the time when the book of Daniel is placed, and the writing of Ezekiel, we can cross-reference practically everything which is written in Ezekiel, for instance. There are references in the Babylonian Chronicles, and there are further references than that, if you follow them, to Egyptian Chronicles and so forth, which define in considerable detail the events which we find referenced in Ezekiel. We also find many of the people that are referenced in Jeremiah and Ezekiel referenced in those documents. So there's no question at all about the facts which we have before us here. And what we have done then is look at some of the Bible-related discussions of how we got into the situation that Ezekiel found themselves in. It's interesting that the comments just before me mentioned Asa, and we had referred to Asa on a number of occasions, because Asa went so far as to remove his mother from the office that she had taken. Maacah was his mother-in-law, I'm sorry, and he had her removed from the offices that she was performing in the temple, because she had erected in the temple courtyard a pole to a female goddess, and she was functioning there as a priestess in the confines of the temple during the time when Asa was king. And Asa, in his early reforms, as was mentioned this evening, removed, among other things, his mother-in-law and the effigy which she was worshipping. But more particularly, I want to go back and look quickly at something which happened in the second book of Kings during the time of Josiah, before we go back to before we go back to Elijah and thence on to the first chapter of Ezekiel's prophecy. 2 Kings 23, we're now in the time of Josiah. To pick up three verses for you, verse 9, firstly, "Nevertheless, the priests of the high places came not up to the altar of the Lord in Jerusalem." So they were priests, and they officiated on the tops of mountains, in the groves, in the high places which had been set up and which were there for the purpose of worshipping the various Canaanite gods and goddesses. The priests came not up to Jerusalem, but these priests did eat of the unleavened bread among their brethren. So quite obviously they were Levites, and quite obviously they were officiating in religious rites which they should not have been following. They didn't go into the temple. They had that much respect for the temple. But we're going to see something else which was going on in the temple in a moment. But they did still consider it their rights as Levites to be supported by the offerings which the people brought to maintain the priesthood. Verse 12. "And the altars that were on top of the upper chamber of Ahaz, which the kings of Judah had made, and the altars which Manasseh had made, in the two courts of the house of the Lord, did the king beat down." Now, what was that? It meant that within the courtyards of the temple, there were altars erected to Canaanite gods and goddesses. It also means that on the roof of the temple structure itself, there were also high places to these Canaanite gods and goddesses. And it also meant that there were Levites who were functioning in the temple structure itself at the rites which went on in those altars which had been erected to Canaanite gods and goddesses. Verse 13. "And the high places that were before Jerusalem, which were on the right hand of the Mount of Corruption, And I don't profess to know exactly what this is. There's been a lot written about it, but I'm not convinced that anybody has really got it sorted out properly. But just beyond the confines of the Temple Mount, there are several high ridges in Jerusalem that could suffice for this. And on one of them, Solomon had built a whole sequence of groves and places which the various wives that he brought in, they were judicious marriages. They were political alliances. They cemented trade. They cemented foreign treaties. They secured peace for the kingdom which Solomon governed. They were judicious political moves, all these various ladies that he married. But they brought their religions with them, and just a little way away from the temple confines, Solomon had built a whole series of tree plantings and little shrines which were there for the gods which these various ladies from afar brought with them. Same sort of thing we're going to see in a moment when we get back to Jezebel. So, all this was going on in the temple confines, on the roof of the temple, in the area surrounding the temple. What was happening in the temple? Well, Josias set out to sort those things out, and if we went any further in this chapter, we would see what Josiah succeeded in achieving. But now, let's go back to the section which was read from 1 Kings 18. But before we do that, let's just think for a moment that the thing which we're going to see shortly in Ezekiel came, this bright object, came to Ezekiel from the north, and it came, as it were, as a wind. It came with a lot of movement, a lot of force, a lot of noise. It was, as it were, a great wind coming, surrounding this bright series of objects, which we'll look at a little later. If you read some of the translations of the archives from Ugarit, and Ugarit is in present-day Lebanon. It's in the sort of northern part of Lebanon. The tell was excavated a number of years ago, and most of the archives are in the Louvre in France, in the National Museum there. If you read some of those translations, you find that Baal was described as the god of the wind and the storm. And there are references in those tablets from Ugarit to Baal riding in on the wind and coming, as it were, is part of the storm. Baal was the god of the storm and the wind. If you think about the way the winds blow, over here, most of the prevailing winds come from the west. They come across the Pacific Ocean. They bring moisture, which they pick up as they come across the ocean. And as the air currents rise on the hillsides, the rain falls. Exactly the same thing happens in the Mediterranean. The prevailing winds come from the west. They flow across the Mediterranean. And as they get to the Judean hills, the water drops on that side. If you get further up into Galilee, a little further north, there's a bit more rain. But it's from this effect of the prevailing west wind that most of the rainfall comes in the land of Israel. God, the god of the wind, according to the Canaanites, was Baal. When the wind blows from the east, it's very dry. It comes across the deserts. And unseasonable winds from the east can cause enormous crop failures. They desiccate everything. And there are references later on in Ezekiel to these east winds which destroy everything in front of them because they dry them right out. The wind which comes from the north is usually quite benign. It cools things down, and when the north wind blows, it's usually sort of at a time when you like to get a little bit of relief from the heat. And sometimes you can even bring a little bit of moisture with those north winds. What's all this got to do with what we're talking about? We We're going to come back to the matter of wind in a little while. But remember that Baal is the god of the wind and the storm. And what Elijah said to Ahab was that because of what Jezebel had been achieving in the land, there was going to be a drought. In other words, the west wind, the wind that Baal brought seasonally, was not going to blow. And there would not be the rain that they depended on to grow their crops. That was what Elijah said to Ahab. But it's one thing to say, well, yeah, I mean, God of the Hebrews has been able to stop the wind from blowing and stop the rain from coming. But it's quite another to actually say, well, now the rain's going to come. And that was what we saw in that event. We tend to focus when we look at the events which are there in that book, 1 Kings chapter 18, on the destruction of the prophets of Baal. We tend to focus on the fire which came down from heaven. We tend to focus on Elijah making the point that the prophets of Baal couldn't bring fire from heaven, which incidentally was one of Baal's functions, if it was lightning that actually came down. That wind and storm and lightning and rain, all of those things were the preserve of the Canaanite god, which we have described for us in the Old Testament as Baal. And so Elijah sent his servant when the prophets of Baal had been subdued, let's put it that way. And he said, look to the west. That's not west, but anyway. Why look west? Actually, it is west out there, isn't it? Mackenzie runs just about east and west. Yeah. Why look west? Because that's where the wind needed to come from that would bring the rain, which would do away with the drought that those people had been suffering for several years. And he went seven times. And eventually the word came back, I can see something. I can see something like a hand rising above the ocean when he looked out from Mount Carmel over the Mediterranean. It's interesting. It's something which you can really see if you're on a hillside in sort of central BC. You can watch the storms come towards you. You can see a little cloud develop. You can see it in the prairies too, as Fred can probably tell you. And you see almost a column of air coming towards you. And feel the rain and the cool air coming as it does. Baal should have been able to do that. But he didn't. He didn't. He couldn't. It was the God of Israel that actually brought that about. And that was the message which came out of Elijah. And the record which we had read for you this evening. So, with that in mind, that Baal was the god of the wind and the storm and the rain and all of those other things, let's look at Ezekiel chapter 1 for a second. We said previously that when the word of the Lord came expressly to Israel, when he was in the land of the Chaldeans, that the point which was being made there was that the Jewish God was not restricted to the confines of the temple. Now that was a radical idea for most of the people that lived at that time. They considered the various gods to belong to a particular piece of territory. The god controlled the territory, and the people who were on that territory then worshipped the god and expected the god to care for them within, as long as they behaved themselves within that god's territory. The message was made quite clearly that God, the God of the Israelites, was not confined to the territory which held him within his temple and its immediate surroundings. This God went much further in his effect than that. And I looked, says Ezekiel, in the fourth verse, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north. A whirlwind came out of the north. Now that in itself was unusual, as we have said, because the strong winds came either from the east or the west. This one came from the north. And if you look at the Hebrew words which are there, there are two words. One of them means something like a hurricane. It means a very strong wind. But there's another word attached to it. And that's the word ruach. And Christadelphians, when they get hold of that word, really drive home the idea that what you're really looking at here is breath, is a movement of air. And the word is translated spirit a great deal throughout the Old Testament. And we have the connection then, as it were, between the Spirit of God, which moved on the face of the waters in Genesis, and the whole idea that it is God that brings about these movements of air. And this whirlwind, this wind, is referenced for us in a number of places. I'd like to look at Psalm 104, and I'm doing this intentionally, and we'll come back to some of the thoughts which are surrounded with these psalms in a few minutes. Psalm 104, in the first four verses. Bless the Lord, O my soul. O Lord my God, thou art very great, thou art clothed with honor and majesty, who coverest thyself with light as with a garment, who stretchest out the heavens with a curtain, who layeth the beams of his chambers in the waters, who maketh the clouds his chariot, who walketh upon the wings of the wind, who maketh his angels spirits, his ministers a flaming fire. Now we're going to meet almost all of those words again in a few minutes as we work our way down through Ezekiel. So the point which is being driven here is that even though the Canaanites describe their god Baal as the one who rode on the wind, the psalmist is saying exactly the same thing. Elijah had made the point that Baal, although he was supposed to ride on the wind, could not control the wind, could not stop it from coming and preventing the rain from falling, could not start it from coming when it brought the rain later. Baal didn't control the wind. And that is one of the points which is driven home repeatedly here in these first few chapters in Ezekiel. Most of the people who lived at the time of Ezekiel in the land of Judea had Baal in the back of their minds. We spent quite a bit of time earlier on looking at the eighth chapter of Ezekiel. All of these foreign gods are, many of them anyway, not all of them, are mentioned there in that eighth chapter. What we saw from the time of Josiah was very much true also in the time of Ezekiel. Most of the people, many of the priests, maybe even most of the priesthood, at least paid lip service to the service of gods like Baal. We saw that from the time of Josiah, and it was equally true in the time of Ezekiel. Baal was the one who was supposed to ride on the wind, but it was the God of Israel who could actually do it. And that's the point. It's comparing what many of them had in their belief structures to what they should have had in their minds, which is going on here in these early verses in Ezekiel. What most of you think is wrong, in so many words, that's what Ezekiel was saying here. That's what the psalm tells us. Psalm 148 talks about stormy winds fulfilling his words. And there's a book in our library, incidentally, in the selling library, that picks up that very idea. I'd like to just show you one more little verse on this topic. It's in Ezekiel. It's in Isaiah 66, 15th verse. For behold, the Lord will come with fire, and with his chariots like a whirlwind, to render his anger with fury and his rebuke with flames of fire. And there we're looking forward. And there we're using almost exactly the same words as we have here in the start of this prophecy of Ezekiel's. So before we come back to this first chapter, I'd like to go just briefly to the 10th chapter of Ezekiel. And as we've commented on this chapter before when we were working in this, the second talk which we did on Ezekiel, that in chapters 10 and 11, in chapters 9, 10, and 11, we see a gradual movement of the Spirit of God when it lifts up, appear from where it was within the holy place, moves to the outer court, and eventually leaves the city entirely and sits on the Mount of Olives. The glory of the Lord in the fourth verse of this 10th chapter went up from the cherub and stood over the threshold of the house, and that's the one reference which we have there. In the 14th verse, we meet again the creatures which we'll look at in a few minutes again from the first chapter of Ezekiel. They're four living creatures. Every one of them had four faces. But I want to point something out to you here before we go back to the first chapter. The first was the face of a cherub, the second a face of a man, the third a face of a lion, and the fourth a face of an eagle. But that's not what Ezekiel saw in the first chapter. What Ezekiel saw in the first chapter was the first with the face of a man, the second with the face of an ox, the third with the face of a lion, and the fourth face was that of an eagle. In other words, the ox and the cherub have been changed. Why? One question for you. Now, when we look at what's there in the first chapter, we see this vision of wheels and the four living creatures and the light and all of the brilliance that was attached to it and all of the other language which we'll look at shortly surrounding this thing which came from the north. And above it was, as it were, a firmament. And the firmament was described as being like crystal. And the word there probably means like ice. So it's a brilliant blue color. And when you're looking at the blueness of hard ice, the crystalline ice, in this firmament which was above that. And in the firmament was a throne, and something on the throne, and we'll look at that in a few minutes. But in this, you see, in the 20th verse of the 10th chapter, and this is the living creature which I saw under the God of Israel by the river Kibar. And I knew that they were cherubims. Everyone had four faces apiece. Everyone had four wings, and the likeness of the wings of a man was under their wings, and the likeness of their faces was the same faces which I saw by the river Kibar, but they weren't the same faces which he saw by the river Kibar. And their appearances and themselves, they went everyone straight forward. In other words, it's almost identical, but not quite. There are two things missing, two things different. One was one of the faces was different. And the second point is that the image of God was not above. This, what he saw in the 10th chapter, whereas it had been when it came to Ezekiel in Babylon in the first chapter. So what was above this image here in the 10th chapter? When it finally moved, it was the glory of God leaving the temple. So God did get there eventually, up above this image, this vision, whatever it was. And it was there to leave the temple, which Ezekiel had spent so much of his life in, which Ezekiel had spent so much of his working life, his serving, his whole way of life had been built around what went on in the temple. I wonder what Ezekiel thought about those other altars which were there. I wonder what Ezekiel thought about having Tammuz there, which was a Babylonian god, which had presumably arrived fairly recently as trade with Babylon had started to expand. And then with the Babylonian army, it more or less had to be there. I wonder what Ezekiel thought about the way those 25 people who stood with their backs to the Lord and their censers full of incense to these Canaanite gods, as they looked at the rising sun, as they looked east, and as they looked at the place where the Spirit of God was going, when they should have been able to see God leave, but presumably they didn't have the slightest idea that God had left them in their temple. It's reminiscent of what Jesus said when the apostles took him up onto the Mount of Olives, and he wanted to look back at the temple. Why did the disciples want to take Jesus up onto the mountain to look back at the temple? Because it had only recently been finished. The temple was not completed in Herod's lifetime. The temple was completed after Herod had died. And the magnificence of that structure was only a year or two old when Jesus was there with his disciples. And the disciples wanted to go back and just look at, just take a few minutes off from a hectic teaching career, look back at the temple and talk about the wonders of their temple. And Jesus said, it looks great. In so many words, it's grand, but it's yours, he said to those who were there, and it's desolate. And that was where we find ourselves here, when Ezekiel was by the river Kibar in Babylon. So, just keep in mind that there were those two differences. Firstly, that the vision came, God was not above it. Secondly, that one of the faces was different. Now, I want you to remind you, at any rate, that the worship in the temple had a rather set routine. One of the principal offerings, which took place very regularly, was the presentation of the burnt offering. The burnt offering was prepared to the north side of the altar, and then the prepared animal was placed on the altar and consumed in the fire that was there on the altar. So north is there, and just keep north in your mind for a minute. The other thing which went on in the temple was that there was music there. And the music, as we have seen in previous Bible classes, was initiated in the time of David, before the temple was even constructed. We have record of David setting aside groups of people to act as choirs. We have David dedicating psalms, and those references for us are there in Samuel and in Kings, that David set out to organize the temple worship while he was beginning to gather things together, and Solomon then was the one who actually constructed the temple. And we remember that when the temple was dedicated, that there's a little phrase in Chronicles that the priests could not stand. They couldn't stand up. They couldn't stand to minister because of the cloud that penetrated the temple. And the words associated with that cloud also indicate to us that there was brilliance, there was light, there was brightness there. So the whole temple was filled with this almost misty brilliance that you couldn't see through, and you really couldn't operate in the presence of it. It's important that we keep these phrases in mind, because we're going to pick them up again and again. Now, the other thing which happened, of course, was that the temple, the sacrifices and the presentation of everything that happened within the confines of the temple were accompanied by music and singing. And we've talked in the past about working our way through the book of Psalms, and there are Psalms which were obviously there for harvest festivals. There are Psalms which were there for other times within the Jewish religious year. So they had, as it were, the same sort of hymn book that we do. You can open your hymn book and there's a little, you know, section on the Word of God. There's a section on praise, there's a section on Psalms and so forth. And you can pick hymns which suit the tenor of the meeting that we're conducting by looking within those various headings. That was there for the Israelites. The Psalms were the book of hymns for the temple. Why raise that? Why raise that point? Because as we've already showed you, when Ezekiel was looking for words to describe what he saw here in these visions, those words very frequently came out of the Psalms. The stormy wind which fulfilled God's word, Psalm 148, seventh verse if I remember rightly. And the whirlwind which came, or the appearance of a whirlwind, which came with the vision. The ideas which Ezekiel wrote down were clothed with ideas which he must have heard daily when they were sung in the worship in the temple. It makes you really respect somebody, doesn't it? When you see what has happened throughout his life. When you realize what was there in the temple at the time when Ezekiel was there. Beginning of the eighth chapter. Now, you see, this came from the north. What was the significance of the north? Well, the significance of the north was, as we've indicated, that the burnt offering was prepared on the north side of the altar. But if you go to the eighth chapter of Ezekiel, about a third of the way down the chapter, you find a north gate to the temple being mentioned. And inside the north gate, you have an image, in my translation, which is described as an image of jealousies. And if you fish around with those words and look for parallels within the Old Testament, it's quite obvious that that was something which Ezekiel found completely reprehensible. It was some kind of effigy which we don't have a precise description of. But it was an effigy which was absolutely abhorrent. We mentioned to you a couple of talks back that the word which is used for idol throughout Ezekiel is a word which describes a little ball of something or other. It probably referred to the ball of dung which the dung beetles rolled up and rolled along the ground. So when Ezekiel was talking about these images which were present in people's houses and present in the temple, he used language which cast them as the little balls of dung that the dung beetles rolled along the ground. That was the way Ezekiel saw what was going on in the temple at the time. And so from the north, when you went into the temple, there was that image. And it was disgusting. It should not have been there. That's the point that Ezekiel is making in chapter 8. And yet, this vision which Ezekiel saw came from that same direction. Why? Because the north was important. Because the burnt offering, which was the basis of Mosaic service, was prepared on the north side of the altar. And God came like a whirlwind from the same side that the burnt offering was prepared. And what came? What came with him? A great cloud. A cloud such as the cloud that we saw when the temple was first dedicated. A cloud like the cloud which was on the mountain when Moses went up to receive the law. A cloud like the cloud that led the Israelites out of Egypt into the promised land. Clouds keep coming up, don't they? And there are many psalms which pick up that image of the cloud which led the people and which promoted deliverance. And the next thing which comes up is fire. Enfolding itself is the phrase in my translation, which really means that the fire was sort of contained. If you, I don't know what you have in your translation, but there are many new translations and quite a number of different words which are used to express the idea here. But it really means that as was the fire with the burning bush, that the fire perpetuated, it continued, it stayed alive in brightness, but it didn't destroy anything. It didn't flow off huge flames here and there. It was contained, it was controlled. That was the fire. And a brightness was about it. Let's have a look at a couple of Psalms and show you where Ezekiel's language is coming from. Psalm 105, verse 39. Egypt was glad when they departed. This is the section of Jewish history that we're referring to. That's the 38th verse of Psalm 105. Egypt was glad when they departed, for the fear of them fell upon them. He spread a cloud for a covering and a fire to give light in the night. And the people asked, and he brought quails and satisfied with them with the bread of heaven. He opened the rock and the waters gushed and so forth. The cloud and the fire. Psalm 18. Psalm 18 has a lot of these words, a lot of these words. Psalm 18, verse 8. There went up a smoke out of his nostrils and fire. In my distress I called upon the Lord is the sixth verse, and this is describes to you what we're talking about. The earth shook in the seventh verse, and the foundations of the hills were moved. Then went up a smoke out of his nostrils, fire from his mouth devoured. Coals were kindled by it. He bowed the heavens also and came down, and darkness was upon his feet, and he rode upon a cherub. And did fly, yea, he did fly upon the wings of the wind. He made darkness his secret place, his pavilion round about him were dark waters and thick clouds of skies, and brightness that was before him as thick clouds passed, hailstones and coals of fire. All of those words are there. All of those words are there to describe what Ezekiel saw. Ezekiel was drawing from the words that he must have heard almost on a daily basis to describe this. Ezekiel's mind was filled with the hymns that he heard when the offerings were being presented. There's another translation for the word which is given here as brightness, and that's shinings. And you remember that Moses' face did shine when he came down from the mountains. And there's a phrase in the 67th Psalm that causes face to shine upon us. And the same word is there in Isaiah 60, where we're talking about the Gentiles shall come to thy brightness, and kings to the brightness of thy rising. So, we're looking here at biblical imagery. As we said, what we're going to do is gradually build up a sort of retrospective view of what Ezekiel saw, rather than looking at a more visionary aspect. The four creatures are a little difficult to look at completely in a retrospective framework, because they occur again in Revelation, of course. When they occur in Revelation, they've got the same faces that we find here in the first chapter of Ezekiel, and different than the ones which we find in the 10th chapter of Ezekiel. The four creatures then had the appearance of a man. I'd like to read you a little section from Daniel 10. Now keep in mind that Daniel was taken captive into Jerusalem. Insofar as the history of what's going on takes place, the first people to be taken captive into Babylon were, of course, the more prominent members of society, those who could lead an insurrection, as it were, against the Babylonians. The second wave took tradespeople, artificers, and one and like that, and we have references to some of them, their names and their their functions in the archives, which have been found in the Babylonian library. So we know again that that happened. And the third wave of captives took practically anybody that could stand and be, as it were, a problem for the Babylonians. And the Babylonians then left only so many people in the land of Israel that could actually farm it and produce crops and then pay taxes, because that was really what the Babylonians wanted. They wanted that land as a sort of source of revenue, as a source of agricultural produce. they wanted to milk it, in so many words. So, Daniel and Ezekiel then were contemporary. They probably didn't meet again if they had met earlier, because Daniel was in the, strictly within the confines of the city of Babylon. Ezekiel, it seems, almost certainly was ministering to the people throughout the remainder of his life that were prisoners and were assigned to the agricultural areas which surrounded the city of Babylon, along with many of those who actually were there to work the fields for the Babylonians. So in Daniel 10, as we said, same time, same place, I lifted up mine eyes in verse 5, and I looked. And behold, a certain man clothed in linen, whose loins were girded with fine gold of Uphaz. Now, at this particular time, Daniel was outside the city, not too far away, but nonetheless outside the city, and that's when he received this particular vision. I lifted up mine eyes, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen, whose loins were girded with fine gold of Uphaz. His body also was like the beryl, and his face as the appearance of lightning, and his eyes as lamps of fire, and his arms and his feet like in color to polished brass, and the voice of his words like the voice of a multitude. And I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, and then on it goes with the words which relate the vision to what was happening in Daniel's life. In the first chapter of Ezekiel, the appearance is as burnished brass, but it's the same word. And burnishing and polishing are really essentially the same process, depending on how hard you work at it. Burnished brass, polished brass was the appearance. It's color like beryl. And we meet that gem again in Ezekiel number 1. And it was no doubt the beryl that came from Spain at that time, a clear yellow color and a very brilliant sort of pale yellow, the color that came from that stone, so that you could almost see through the stone, but nonetheless it had that yellowness which one associates with a hot fire. And his face is the appearance of lightning, and we have that word again in Ezekiel. And the voice of his words was like the voice of a multitude, but in Ezekiel we meet the idea of the sound of many waters. So, the point that I want to draw your attention to is that the same language is being used to describe essentially the same thing. The appearance of a person which came to give a message from God to one who was willing to receive that message. Now, we've seen many times as we worked our way through these first 24 chapters of Ezekiel that the elders came to Ezekiel to hear what he had to say. But we also hear many times, repeatedly, that the people who heard his message really didn't pay much attention to it. And finally, at the end of the 20th chapter, Ezekiel says, you know, they think I'm talking in Proverbs. In one place, they said, well, you know, we sort of go along with that, but you're talking about things that are not going to happen for a long time yet. Yeah, maybe the city will be destroyed. Maybe the temple will be destroyed, but not in our lifetime, in so many words. Nothing that we need to worry about. That was what surrounded Ezekiel. That was the attitude. Even though the elders came to him to hear his words. Even though he was respected because of his background as a priest. They nonetheless didn't take seriously what he said. It's interesting, isn't it, that it was Daniel said the others didn't see the vision. Anybody else that was around didn't see it. Daniel was the only one who saw it. Why? Because Daniel was the one with his mind and his eyes open. We commented earlier on those 25 men who were looking for the rising sun in the outer court of the temple, looking in the direction that God was going. They couldn't see him. They were concerned with the God, Canaanite God, that brought the brightness into their lives, that brought the sun into their lives, that looked after the regular goings-on in the world. And isn't that interesting? Let's, before we go any further, look at the last verse in Ezekiel. And then we'll come back to where we were. And as the appearance of the bow that is in the clouds in the day of rain, so was the appearance of the brightness round about. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of God. And in Genesis 9, we have the point which is being referred to. The bow that is in the heavens, accompanying the rain. And God said, this is a token of the covenant which I have made between me and you, and every living creature that is with you for a perpetual generation, for perpetual generations. This is the covenant that God made with everything that was on the earth. I set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be two words which we have here from Ezekiel. I set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be for a token of a covenant between us, between me and the earth. It shall come to pass when I bring a cloud over the earth that the bow shall be seen, and I will remember my covenant. Remember my covenant. And the covenant was that so long as the earth endure, that seed time and harvest should not fail. We have to go back, don't we, to think about what was going on in people's minds. And this is where the exhortation lies for people today. We live in an era when all religions are considered equivalent. There are at least three great religions in the world, and we're told that regularly by our politicians and social scientists and so forth. We should respect them all. We shouldn't consider any one to be better than any other. And that was what was going on in Israel in Ezekiel's day. All these religions were equivalent. The God who belonged in the temple in Jerusalem was no different than any of the others, and they thought so because they were looking to the God who made the sun rise. They still remembered that Baal was the god of the storm. They looked to not just to Yahweh, but also to Asherah to look after them in the afterlife, as we have seen from an inscription in at least one tomb in southern Judea. What were their minds thinking of? What were their minds thinking of? That was what Ezekiel had to fight. And that was why Ezekiel filled these images with words from the Old Testament. That was why, as each one of these words come out, if you've read your Old Testament, there's a whole cascade of ideas which come along with each word, which prime us to realize that God does dwell in the kingdoms of men and that God does reign in the kingdoms of men. And we should be aware of that even today. The Jews in Ezekiel's time weren't aware of it. A lot of people in our day aren't aware of it. But we in our day should look for exactly what Ezekiel looked for, and that was the deliverance of God. I don't know, I seem to have a habit of taking rather a long time when we get into these topics. What are we going to talk about for a minute? Let's comment on two things. One is the idea that each one of these living creatures had wings. They all had four wings. Wings are interesting because the word which is in the Hebrew can mean a wing, but there are uses of the word which also mean a sort of margin and edge of your garment and so forth. And so the edge of the priest's garment is quite often referred to by the same word which is there. Translated wing. But the interesting thing is that if you look at the number of times the word wing is used, it's used a great many times in Ezekiel. It's used again when the temple is being instructed. Why? Because there were wings for each of the cherubim, which were there within over the mercy seat. And that's repeated many times through Kings and Chronicles. And in Ezekiel here, we're assured of this fact of there being wings, the wings touching one another, and the wings sheltering the figure that was beneath them. But interestingly, the wings aren't given any thought that they're part of a propulsion system. It's interesting that the face looks in one direction. I'm looking over here right now. And it said that the spirit is the word which is we have there further on down. Where the spirit went, that's where they went. Where their intention was to go, that was where they went. And if they wanted to go this way, well, they had a face on that side too, and that face led them in that direction. But it's intentional movement, and the movement is not there brought about by a movement of the wings. So what are the wings? They're there to share, to shelter, to focus your mind. When the above the mercy seat, the wings came forward, and the two cherubs looked down, and it's almost certain that the viewpoint of the two cherubs was to where the Shekinah light should have been, where it was in the early days. So they were looking toward the glory of God. And that's the image which we have here. The wings come around and the faces, even though there are four of them, the one face, the face of the man, is always looking in toward the center. And what was the central aspect of this vision which came? The central aspect was this fire, which didn't consume. The central aspect was the brilliance of that yellow-colored stone, that beryl stone. The word sapphire is also used a little further down. The central aspect was where all the lightning emanated, as it were. Not huge bolts of lightning, surely, but flashes which appeared to be as lightning. In other words, it was there with this cloud of brilliant light and this cloud which gave forth great streaks of brilliant, as it were, lightning. And so what they're looking at then is a representation of the glory of God. The man is, in these four faces, the man, of course, is presented to us. We looked in Daniel. The man took Ezekiel around the temple, and there are several places where we have the likeness of a man, which is there as a guide through God's word. The lion and the ox, the other two faces, were very present within the castings, which were made, the bronze castings, within the temple. The lion and the ox were together on the basis for the great sea, which was used to wash the priest's hands. The eagle is very interesting because there's a little phrase that the Israelites were born with eagle's wings when they were brought out of Egypt. There's a little phrase in Isaiah that they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength and they shall mount up as eagle's wings. So we have all of these ideas being brought together in the different faces of the four living creatures. The calls we've seen from Psalm 18, which are there again. So that little comment about the wings, that the wings were not used for propulsion. They were rather used to shade, to shelter, and to focus the attention down toward the glory of God. And let's think about thrones for just a moment. When we get down into the likeness of the firmament, which is there in the 22nd verse, up above this vision of living creatures with their wings and all the brilliant lights which are there, up above that was this firmament which had the color of ice, and within the firmament was a throne, and on the throne was the likeness of a man. We take chairs for granted nowadays. Everybody has a number of different chairs in their house. We have easy chairs, you know, if you want to sit down quietly at night. We have chairs which you may pack off down to the workshop because they're rougher and harder. We have chairs which you sit at the table if you're going to eat. We have different chairs for everything. In the days when this word was written, a chair was a very unusual thing. Most people had a sort of bench which was carved into the wall of the house, a few stones sort of piled up on the lower part of the outside walls, and that's where people sat. And the bench would go right along to the end, and then one corner would again be a little bench for somebody to sit at who was doing the cooking, and a little stove, an open area, an open fireplace in one corner, which again was raised stone, and that was used to heat the place and for cooking purposes. In most people's houses, there were no chairs. Most people never saw a chair. More people who had a little more money might have a chair, and that would be the chair that the master of the house would sit in on occasion. It would also be the chair that you would offer to a respected guest if someone of some importance came to visit you. Chairs were unusual things. And chairs people spent a lot of effort on because they were unusual, because they were luxury items, and because they were special pieces of furniture. We know that Solomon put a lot of work into the chair that he sat on when he presided over the nation of Israel. He carved that chair and he really made an ornate throne for him to sit on. A throne was something very important. It was not something which everybody had. And it was something that demanded not respect for several reasons. One was the respect that came because not everybody had one. Other points was the respect that came because they were reserved for very special purposes. And the other item in which respect came for those who had chairs was that if you had a chair, you had almost certainly put a lot of your time, your effort, your money, and your intellect into arranging a chair which was suitable for your purposes. Why raise all this? Because it shows the mindset which was there in Ezekiel's day. It showed the importance of the chair which came within the firmament and which was above the vision which Ezekiel saw. Ahab had a palace of ivories, and it's almost certain that his throne was inlaid with ivory, for instance. It was an impressive thing. It was not something that people regularly saw. So the throne which was there was meant to impress. When the vision left the temple in the 10th, 11th chapters, God rode above that without his chair. When God came to visit Ezekiel by the river Kibar, God was present, or the representative of God, because it's the likeness of a man, was there within the throne. And when you think about the importance of the throne, you think about the continuing kingship of the nation of Israel, we think about the fact that although the vision had its place within the temple, that the vision actually has its greater place within the nations of the world. And we think that the heavens are God's throne, the earth is his footstool. And yet God deemed to show his throne coming to Ezekiel on that occasion. What does that mean? Well, I suspect that the ox was not present in chapter 10. Because the sacrifices which had been made, the ox was, it's the bullock, the ox which was there for the burnt offering. The meaning of that had been destroyed by those people. When the Spirit of God left the temple, it was there because the ox had not been treated properly within the confines of Moses. And yet the spirit of Moses' teaching was nonetheless there to Ezekiel by the river Kibar. But what's intended with the throne of God being there was something which would extend much beyond the nation of Israel when that throne should sit over the whole world. For that surely is what the word firmament implies when it's there above the vision.